It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're spending our entire show today looking at the role of labor unions, the part they have played in the history and economic development of the country and the region, and what role they play in our future. I'm joined now by phone from Washington by Philip Dine, labor author, speaker, and commentator. He is the author of the book State of the Unions. Philip Dine, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Unions are credited with helping create the middle class. Is the sharp decline in union membership a reason why the middle class seems to be shrinking in our country?
You know, you just put your finger on labor's single biggest challenge, which is to make that point. The answer is yes. But the problem is labor hasn't really helped people connect the dots. You know, people see all around them their own problems, their neighbors or families, declining salaries, job security, and so on, and they know that's bad, high unemployment. On the other hand, they see a declining labor movement, at least numerically, and they sort of shrug, and they think that's either inevitable or it doesn't matter or whatever. But until labor can do what you just indicated in your question, connect the dots between the decline in the middle class and the decline in labor, labor's going to have a challenge.
Well, and I cited the figure of decline in union membership from a peak in the 1950s of 35% down to 11% today, give or take. We had a caller who said it's more like 8 or 9, but you know, within that 3% margin of error, you're looking at a much lower figure than traditionally has existed. Why is union membership declining so dramatically?
Well, first of all, you're right. It's about 11%. In the private sector, maybe your caller is alluding to that, it's about 7%. It's higher in the public sector. It's declining for several reasons. I mean, it started declining in the 50s, and it was a gradual decline as our economy gradually shifted away from manufacturing. But it became a precipitous decline after the early 80s when Ronald Reagan had the showdown with PATCO, because that sent a signal to employers that the old rules didn't apply. They could be more aggressive in trying to keep unions out of the workplace. So it's declined for several reasons, I think. One is just economic changes in the country. We've gone away from manufacturing, which is really where labor was born and remained strongest for a long time, towards more of a service sector job economy. And so manufacturing went overseas or went to right-to-work states down south, and manufacturing is disproportionately union. So that's one factor. Another factor is that, as I said, especially after the early 80s, employers have become way more aggressive in terms of keeping unions out of the workplace. You know, one of the few booming industries in this country is something called union avoidance industry, which counsels employers, company owners, on how to keep unions out. And the first thing they tell them is the best way to win a union election is to avoid having it in the first place. So usually legally, sometimes skirting the law, and sometimes outright illegally, companies do a lot to keep unions out. It's now harder to form a union in the United States than in any Western democracy. And that's actually true. It sounds strange, but that's actually true. And the third reason I'd say is that unions have made some mistakes. You know, they haven't communicated to the public why unions are in the national interest, what the links are between unions and middle class, and so on. So unions need to do a lot better job communicating these things.
In the interest of looking at this issue fairly from both sides, I mean, clearly there were workers in the late 1900s, early 20th century, were abused. And for many years, decades even, management, company owners got away with it. The unions stepped in. They represented the workers. They were able to achieve some level of equity. And then, as some see it, the pendulum shifted and unions started to make it difficult for companies to stay in business simply because they could not necessarily afford to pay people all of the benefits that had been negotiated fairly, but enormous benefits nonetheless. So then the question becomes, is it fair for businesses to have to accede to all of the demands of the unions? Is there a fair and more equitable way to make it possible for businesses to do what they need to do to achieve their bottom line?
Look, I don't know if there's been a single case ever where a company has acceded to all of the demands of unions. It's always a give and take. But I think what your question really gets at is, have unions ever overreached? Sure. I mean, I don't think there's an institution in this country that has a perfect track record of always being moderate, reasonable, compromising, et cetera. Sure, unions have overreached. Sure, management's overreached at times. But by and large, when you have a strong union and a competent management, they negotiate. And again, nobody, you know, the two sides have to sign a contract for it to go into effect. So unions can demand all they want, or companies can ask for all they want, but both have to agree on the end product. And yeah, there have been times where unions have gone too far. But that's like saying there have been times where management's been corrupt, so we should do away with management. I mean, the point is for unions to be constantly improving, and I think there have been in the past problems with corruption in some unions. Those have almost entirely been weeded out. And again, I think the answer is to not get rid of unions, but to have more effective unions where there are problems.
We're talking with Philip Dine. He is a labor author, speaker, and commentator, and he is the author of the book State of the Unions. Is there a contrast between what's happening with private sector unions and public sector unions? Explain what is going on there.
Oh, boy. Public sector. You know, private sector back in the 50s was almost the entirety of the labor movement. It was about 37% organized in the private sector, and the private sector was almost all of the workforce. Public sector was very small and very, very unorganized. Now it's done a complete 180. As we said before, the private sector is about 7% organized, and public sector is in the high 30s. And 2 years ago, for the first time in American history, the public sector became the majority within the labor movement, which is why Wisconsin and so on are so important. Because now when you go after police and fire and firefighters and teachers and so on, you're going after the heart of the labor movement.
Was that kind of the PATCO moment of the 21st century?
A really good point. And that's what my whole... I just did a revised edition of State of the Unions, and that's what it's about now. You know, why Wisconsin occurred and what it means and why it's so important. You know, it's really got nothing to do with public sector bargaining or state budgets. What it is an effort to destroy once and for all the labor movement in this country, because when you take away their collective bargaining rights for public sector unions, which is what they want to do in Wisconsin, you destroy labor, because there's no reason for a union to exist if it can't collectively bargain. And again, once you destroy the public sector unions, you've destroyed labor in this country. So this is really an existential moment for labor. And it's not just Wisconsin. It's been a lot of states, and labor's won some and lost some. But one thing that Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, did was he really awoke, I don't want to say a sleeping giant, but he awoke labor, because they know now they're, after years of denial, they know they're really in for a huge fight. So it's I agree. Yeah, in a sense, this could be the PATCO moment.
What role should unions serve in the future? Is it the same traditional role that unions have had, representing employees and negotiating on their behalf? Or are we seeing some sort of an evolution here?
Good question. Rich Trumka is the son of Pennsylvania and is now the, in fact, Western Pennsylvania, former coal miner, and is now the president of the AFL-CIO, realizes, and it's taken a long time to have an AFL-CIO leader who really understands this, in my view. He realizes that labor can't do what it's done in the past. You know, labor was born in the factories in Detroit with the Ruther brothers and the United Auto Workers, in the coal mines in southwestern Pennsylvania and West Virginia and so on, and on construction sites. You know, well, coal mining's declining, manufacturing is really declining, and construction remains. But, you know, now we're moving to an information society, to service sector jobs, public sector. So labor's got to and people aren't staying with the same company any for a lifetime. They're working for 10 or 15 or 20 employers. A lot of people work alone or at home. So Trumka realizes that labor can't. I mean, the goals are still the same, to represent workers and achieve a safer workplace and good working conditions and security and so on. But the means have to change, and I think they're in the process of trying to figure that out.
You were outlining, Philip, some situations in which it's been difficult for people to organize or to stay organized. Given all of that and the state of the economy and where our nation may or may not be headed, can unions survive?
Can unions survive? It's a really good question, and I think that's up in the air, because if they get much lower in terms of membership, they're going to reach a critical point where they're almost irrelevant. They're not there yet at all. You know, while they've lost a lot of numbers and they've lost a lot of bargaining strength, they've remained very strong politically. Unions can definitely survive because they are as needed as ever. I mean, we have the biggest gap between the rich and the poor that we've had in 80 years in this country. We have the biggest share of the GDP gross domestic product going to corporate profits, and the smallest going to wages and salaries we've had in a century. So the need for labor, you know, why would it be that at the very moment when corporate power is more concentrated, more distant, and so on, and more powerful, that's the moment when workers can suddenly fend for themselves as individuals? I mean, just on a common sense basis, it's clear that the need for labor is as strong as ever. So labor's got to figure out a way to meet that need. And I think most of all, labor's biggest challenge is to do what you did in your first question, to connect the dots for people as to why a strong labor movement is in the interest not just of union members, but of the middle class and of this country as a whole. And if labor can do that, then it'll not only survive, but thrive.
We've just got about 30 seconds or so left, but do you have some fear of, in a sense, seeing a future that looks like something out of the movie Metropolis in the United States? And we've got about 20 seconds here.
If I'm not that familiar with that movie, but if labor can't, you know, if more and more power is concentrated and labor's more and more marginalized, we're all going to be in trouble, mostly the middle class. But I don't think that'll happen, because I think the need is there for a resurgent labor movement.
Philip Dine is the author of State of the Unions. He joined us by phone from Washington. Philip Dine, thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you.
And thanks for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. And we welcome your comments and story ideas at ESSPGH@WESA.FM. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This is 90.5 WESA, Pittsburgh's NPR News Station.